You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Isaac Lithgow. Isaac, thanks so much for being with me today.
A pleasure to join you, Brainerd.
Isaac, we're talking about your show, of course, at Kudlesa Gallery, Everyone's a Bad Guy. And I'm really looking forward to talking about this. Of course, the show is about to open. Hopefully, listeners will be able to go see the show and look at more of what's happening here. So I want to begin by talking about, there's a main sculpture in the show. There's some paintings in the show. I know we can't talk about all of it too specifically, but I want to talk about narratives and process a bit. So to begin with, the main sculpture in the show, the titular sculpture in the show, is resembles a wolf or some kind of mythic being, right? Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's loosely, I mean, the whole show is sort of built out from the main sculpture, and it's very reflective of the sort of theme through the show, but the sculpture itself is based loosely somewhere between the big bad wolf and Cerberus. And so you have a sort of contortion and flow of limbs and bodies and heads and eyes and materials, and you have the whole sculpture leaning kind of forcefully on a desk. And I was thinking quite a lot about the Isaac Genskin sculpture, The American Room, which is a sort of silver and neon pink painted Donald Duck slamming his finger into a giant office desk. And yeah, it felt like somewhat of an update and a sort of a work that would kind of fit currently into the broader theme of the show.
And let's talk about how you're building that sculpture. Yeah, I want to talk about themes and narratives, of course, as well. But let's talk about process. Does a sculpture like this begin with a drawing, and how is it built? Because this is really the centerpiece of the show. This is something extraordinary about this, right?
Yeah, a sculpture will take me, I really, maybe 500 hours to make. And in fact, I'll start with, I model everything in 3D in ZBrush. And that's a sort of torturous, endless process for me where I edit and re-edit and edit and re-edit. And I'll sort of build out a sculpture into 200 pieces in 3D, and then slowly sort of work out a way until I kind of think I can make it in actual materials. And it's I was thinking about it recently as this sort of, it's like the screenplay for the work, and then actually none of the character casting happens, or the acting or the filming happens, until it's actually made. So there's this division between work and labor. And so I'll take that model, I'll cut it up. Usually I'll 3D print it in kind of the worst quality you could imagine, a 1 millimeter thick 3D print in many parts, which will, instead of making a mold, a buck mold from that, I'll use that as a core material. And so internally and externally, I'll start to build out a lot of the parts into fiberglass. And then others I'll cast in aluminium or carbon wood, or kind of, yeah, sometimes mold as well. But I really wanted a couple of years ago to get away from giant silicon molds and this sort of endless wasteful practice in the studio. And at the same time, it allows me to play with translucency and layering. And so the work's really become, to get them to a finish, maybe 7 layers of different materials and micas and pigments. And yeah, and that's sort of how work starts to build out like that.
Yeah, I love that. It's such a painterly process in a way. I mean, sculptural process, of course, but that's, it's many layers on there, right? We're talking about a lot of layers that you're putting into this.
Exactly, and it comes exactly from making paintings. And so that was something I took years ago from school, and sort of after leaving painting behind for a while, I kind of took, I mean, some of those pigments that I use, I realized, are still from my studio when I was studying at the Royal College 10 years ago, 12 years ago, which is kind of makes me laugh. So there's a sort of consistency that runs through.
I like that. And so this kind of amazing sculpture, right, this kind of centerpiece, it also relates to the title of the show, right? The Everyone's a Bad Guy, which, you know, seems both terrifying and kind of funny, but there's nothing really that funny about this kind of wolf, which is in a way sort of terrifying, right? Can we talk a little bit about the relationship of this major sculpture to the title, Everyone's a Bad Guy?
Yeah, I was looking for a title that sort of played with how the world feels at the moment, and distinctly that polarization that's sort of everywhere. And I wanted to kind of play with post-truth, which I felt was something of a misnomer, and that actually we have more information to kind of verify facts than we've ever had before, but still somewhat there's just this division that we run through. And particularly I've been sort of leaning towards memory in the last couple of years, and how we sort of we work with memory. And every time we remember something, we don't remember the original event, but we re-remember the last time we remembered. So memory,
we're sort of remembering kind of, you mean like it's like remembering the memory itself?
Exactly. Where it's copies on copies on copies. There's an entropy to it. There's this this drift from an original sort of event to how we exist and communicate. And we only really exist in memories. And I sort of felt like it's very reflective of how an idea gets repeated and repeated and repeated, especially in news or social media, to the point where we're so detached from the original event. There was a tech investor that had this sort of episode in May. He was called Jeff Lewis, and he was one of the early funders of OpenAI. And he had this sort of psychological break, which was definitely ChatGPT induced, to the point where he was describing an unsolicited ontological mutation. And I was sort of amazed by this idea that someone could sycophantically communicate with an AI to the point where they distorted their entire sort of metaphysics. And I don't think that's sort of too outlandish. It kind of sounds to me like living in a Magritte painting, but it's also seemingly applicable to many different issues. I think that's kind of like a transferable thought, this unsolicited or ontological mutation. And somewhat it made me think of Nietzsche a bit, and that sort of was a run through the show, was this sort of if you stare into the abyss for too long, the abyss stares back into you. And I thought that was kind of like a nice sort of launching point into the show.
Yeah, I like that very much. It's a very complex question and issue, right? This is the times we're in. It is a bit of the abyss, I guess you could say. And so that's part of the thread that's running through this show, right? This show is also, as I understand, loosely based on a wedding, because there's also paintings throughout here, and there's a story to be told, right? Can you tell me a little bit about it? Because there's a lot of action happening here.
Yeah. So obviously you start with the title like that. I start with the title like that, and I write, and I'm kind of hunting around for a story archetype that might fit. And I was sort of playing with fairy tale and to fairy tale, and I was wondering, like, can that be a verb? Can we sort of go around life fairy-taling things? And it made me think of the fact that the wedding is always cast as this sort of fairy-tale day where you can live in a dream for a day. And I thought that would be a really nice sort of way to distort or to contrast this title, that you actually, you reset the wedding as this sort of disastrous day. And yeah, and it becomes this sort of stand-in as well for for corporate mergers. And yeah, there's a real sort of clash and violence to it, and seduction, and there's romance in it as well. But yeah, I thought it was a nice play.
That's I like that so much. So let's talk more about this, because of course the paintings are in dialogue with that sculpture, right? That's part of what's happening there. How did you
Yeah, the
approach
sculpture.
these paintings? Because these were quite a bit different.
Sorry, say again.
So let's talk about the approach to these paintings, because there's a whole narrative here that's operating around in a way our cultural moment, among other things, but of course also your process. So yeah, let's talk about the paintings and the kind of story that's happening in there, because they do relate to the sculpture, correct?
I mean, absolutely. I think the sculpture could be, that could be your wedding officiator putting his fist onto the lectern or in church, or it could easily be as a sort of a corporate moment. But there's a seduction to it as well. It could be a bride and a groom entangled. But yeah, into the paintings, I think they're funny and violent. And I was talking to a curator friend of mine recently, a few months ago, about the idea. He said no one's making Tarantino paintings at the moment. I thought that was kind of funny, and I thought about it for a day or two, and I realized that there were Tarantino paintings, and that was Caravaggio, and that explicitness in painting was always a thing. And I don't know, I've sort of felt like it was less a thing recently, and it seems to me the most sort of exciting time to actually make paintings, because there's such a saturation of mid aesthetic, of slop aesthetic, of AI images, of a sort of, there's that way that the iPhone mediates how your image comes out, and everyone sort of has an iPhone image. We don't have that vast variance that you get from cameras, and so that whole idea of the photos sort of changed a bit, and I just felt like it was a really great time to start to paint again. And it's been 10 years since I made a painting on canvas, and it felt very liberating to sort of forget every rule and lesson and trick that I'd sort of made into my painting practice, that made me kind of pushed me out of my painting practice years ago. And so yeah, it's been fun. It's been a
So
real.
let's talk about that, getting back to your painting practice, because you've of course been working in other mediums. How did you come back to it, and how was that different than how you were painting before? Because that's what you were initially starting with, painting, correct?
Yeah, I studied painting. I think I made paintings every day for about 10 years, and then by the end, I felt such a sort of strange pressure, I guess, of painting. I didn't really trust paintings in a way, and they'd veered towards materiality and objects and trompe l'oeil, and I don't know, I just felt like I should just make objects at that point. And so I did. And so after I left the Royal College, I taught myself how to make objects, basically. And so to go back, I don't know, I felt that the sculpture practice, I've sort of slowed it down recently, and by that I only mean that it takes longer to make sculptures. So in a year I would be happy if I could make five sculptures, and I always have so many ideas. I think I have the next 2 years of ideas already, and so I wanted to find a way to kind of get through ideas quicker as well. And that to me felt like I should make paintings again. And
And so let's
yeah.
talk about some of the ideas you're moving through, or the process of those paintings, because this sounds like you were in kind of a I don't know, almost not quite a frenzy, but you really jumped right back into that. So as you got back into the paintings, how were they being created? Was your process starting with drawings? Did you plan out the whole series as well?
Yeah, I think I iterated about 500, 1,000 images, really. I spent, that was the spring, the winter through the spring, just I'm a very sort of pre-planned person. I think that's how I approach all of my work. And I go very deep into work mode where I'm very bad at ever taking a day off. And I think that sort of consistency in the studio every day is absolutely essential to sort of build a flow and, and kind of block out distractions and sort of make something I haven't seen before. And it's so hard, I think, to focus now more than ever. And that's sort of, I've been deep into that rabbit hole. But yeah, the images, I draw a lot with the Wacom, with a pen tablet on my computer, and there's a lot of Photoshop, there's a lot of found images. I've had an image archive for years, so they all kind of got mashed into into sort of loose references. And then the paintings themselves, again, were made in about 2 months, all day, every day. I kind of paint at night. It's a strange one. I like it when everyone's sort of gone to bed. I think all the works have been made overnight, to be honest, ever. It's a very special time to work for me.
Yeah, that's so true. That's so interesting. I've heard that before. Night is a special time. I've also heard painters say full moon is a special time. There was one person I interviewed that said, I only paint in the full moon. There's nothing like the full moon. But all these things affect us, I suppose. You mentioned there was the rabbit hole that you got into was around focus, right? Which is kind of one of the dominant issues in a number of ways of our culture right now. If I understood you correctly, can you tell me a little bit about what that meant in terms of your painting process, the rabbit hole of focus? Did I get that right?
Yeah, or flow state, I think, is also an interesting one. You reminded me there of, I think there's a Guston quote from years ago where he says, I go to the studio and, slowly people come during the day and then they leave one by one and then you're left in the studio and then ideally you leave and the paintings make themselves. And I think it's really that that's simply about this idea of flow state and that you're working in a way where you know exactly how to make a painting or mix a color and you just have to sort of let it happen. And I think that's exactly how these paintings happen. I mean, in fact, that's how the sculptures happen. After a certain point, after weeks or a month of technical business, the actual finishing of a sculpture is exactly the same. It's a few sort of sleepless days, just locked into tuning and setting poses and assembly. And
flow state, right? That focused state, that almost trance-like state, I would imagine.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I want to ask one more question before we go. I'm always curious, what are you reading at the moment?
Oh, I'm, as ever, sort of reading about 5 books all at once in weird segments. sort of very persistent and really bad reader, but I am quite a long way into The Magus by John Knowles, which is a sort of 60s postmodern book about a Cambridge graduate, an Oxford graduate who goes to teach on a Greek island and everything starts to get very strange. And alongside that, I'm also reading, rereading for about the fifth time, Cosmopolis by Don DeLillo, which is, I guess, my favorite New York book. And it's this homage to the New York trilogy by Paul Auster as well, which I've always loved, this kind of noir, strange take, sort of out of control take on New York, which, I guess that's sort of slipped in. But apart from that, I can't say and also Mark Fisher, The Weird and the Eerie, which is an autumn book for me every year because it just touches into those strange, dark places and the uncanny. And yeah, I always find something new in it every year. So those three I've really been reading, but I guess there's a couple other things as well. Yeah, like I said, terrible but sort of persistent reader.
Thanks so much. Yeah, those are great books. Thanks for sharing that. I want to thank you for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure for the listeners. I really hope you follow the links and get to see the show. Again, Isaac, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Brenner, thank you so much.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.